my fellow Labour MEP and myself have been doing a series of meetings across the North East constituency, giving an update to members on what's happening with the Brexit process, and giving, if you like, a particularly a view from Brussels, because Jude and I spend most of our time in Brussels, and that's a different perspective to the Westminster perspective, which is the one that you tend to get in the media and from our members of the Westminster Parliament, which is perfectly understandable. But the Brussels view is a bit different. So Jude was down a couple of weeks ago doing a talk on Teesside. I was in Sunderland Central a week last Friday, and it's Blythe, and as I say, we're working our way round. And if you're from the Berwick constituency, we're hoping to find a date to do one specifically at the northern end of Northumberland. So thank you if you've travelled from further afield than Blythe, but also thank you if you've come along from Blythe. Now, I think the main thing to say about the Brexit situation, if we're honest, is nobody knows what's going to happen. If anybody tells you that they know what's going to happen in the next 6 months, they've either had too much of something or they're basically just making it up and lying to you. It's a very strange time in British politics because it's entirely unpredictable about what might happen. Richard Corbett, who's the leader of the Labour group in the European Parliament, who's a Yorkshire Labour MEP, he's got a list of scenarios, and he's got 9 scenarios was his latest on the list, but he reckons there's at least 13. He's got 4 more to write up. So there's a lot of possibilities. And it's interesting timing because we're now only 6 months away from Brexit. That decision, which was taken back in March 2 years ago to trigger the referendum, to trigger Article 50, means that we've now a year and a half down the road with only 6 months to go. And it's a bit like the water going down the plug hole in the bath. It goes round in a big circle and nothing seems to be happening, and then it slowly starts to speed up. And in that last 6 months, it'll move very quickly. And in the last 6 weeks, it'll move even more quickly before we're out, so to speak. And at the end of that 6 months, and Jude and I find this, you know, we keep coming across people who say, oh, you'll be all right. And you say, no, I won't have a job in 6 months' time. There will be no British, oh, really, there'll be no MEPs anymore. That's right, when we leave the European Union, one of the things that happens is we won't be represented anymore in the European Parliament. We won't have members of the European Parliament. And it's surprising how many people, including people in the Labour Party, who think, oh, I didn't realise that we wouldn't have MEPs. So if you're one of the younger people here tonight, the opportunity to be able to tell your grandchildren in 50, 60, 70 years' time that you once went to a meeting in Blythe in their comrades' club and actually saw that now extinct species, the British member of the European Parliament. So when what we're trying to achieve as a country, what the government is trying to achieve, is an exit deal, a deal with our EU 27 colleagues, and that's the deal under which we will leave, and it's a legally binding deal, and they're trying to sort that out at the moment. And as well as sorting out the leaving deal, there's meant to be a framework of which sets out our future relationship with the EU 27. So there's 2 things that they're trying to achieve, and the Chequers meeting, which happened a few weeks back before the summer holidays, was an attempt by the government to nail down what the government's negotiating position would be with the European Union. And we know that that began to unravel very quickly afterwards. We had the resignation of Boris Johnson, the resignation of David Davis. So the government's own negotiating position is very weak when it goes to those meetings in the EU, because it has a lack of support even inside the cabinet for what the Prime Minister's trying to achieve. And it's worth bearing in mind that kind of perspective from Brussels is obviously there needs to be an agreement at the first instance between Michel Barnier, who is the lead negotiator for the EU, and with Dominic Raab, who is the lead negotiator for the United Kingdom. There has to be an agreement between them. That obviously wouldn't happen from Dominic Raab's point of view unless he'd got the support of the Prime Minister and the government behind him. And it wouldn't happen from Michel Barnier's point of view if he didn't have the support of the 27 countries. And that is what we're aiming for, is an agreement around the table between those two people. And we had Keir Starmer, who is in charge for Labour, is the shadow Brexit secretary, the equivalent of Dominic Raab on the Labour side. He was out in Brussels a couple of weeks ago talking to us as the Labour MEPs, and he feels that it'll move very quickly. So if on a Thursday there was an agreement between Dominic Raab and Michel Barnier, on the Monday in the House of Commons the government would be tabling a vote on the Brexit deal. So less than a week, they don't want it to unravel, they'll have nailed it down, and it'll be hammered over in the media over the weekend, and they'll want the vote in the House of Commons on the Monday. Now, the intention was to have the deal done by October. Now, this is September. This is the middle of September, and they wanted it done in 4 weeks' time. It's not going to happen in 4 weeks' time. They're hoping to have it done now in November. So the Council of Ministers meeting, which is scheduled for October, where they had hope to sign it off, if you like, at 27 country level, that isn't going to happen. There's going to be a special conference, the date isn't fixed, a special summit in November. So sometime in November, probably in the middle of November, there'll be that meeting, probably in Brussels, between Michel Barnier and Dominic Raab, where agreement is reached. And on the Monday in the House of Commons, there'll be a vote. And it could be that on that Friday in between, the EU27 meet somewhere with the UK present and sign it off, if you like, at a government level. Now, one of the things that many people don't realise in this scenario, we know there's going to be a vote in the House of Commons, but every European country in their parliament will have a vote. So 27 parliaments will all vote on the deal. Now, some of them might say no for various reasons, but for it to go through, a minimum of 20 countries at an EU level have to agree the deal. And that's one thing that people don't seem to be particularly aware of. A minimum of 20 countries out of the 27 countries have to agree the deal. And there's a second bar that has to be cleared. The 20 countries that vote between them have to represent a minimum of 65% of the population of the European Union. So you couldn't have a situation, if you like, where the 20 smallest EU countries voted for the deal, but the big countries, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Poland, big countries as in large populations, said, no, we're not happy with that. But it went through because 20 smaller countries voted for it. So it's 20 countries plus a minimum of 65% of the population of the 27 countries. So don't presume necessarily that that bar is going to be cleared. So it may be that the British government agree with the governments of the 27, but it then has to go to the parliaments of the countries as well. And in a few cases, like Belgium, it has to go to some sub-parliaments as well. So there's some provincial parliaments who have a vote as well. The European Parliament that we sit in, Jude and I sit in, as the 71 British MEPs in, also has a vote. And the European Parliament has to agree it, otherwise it doesn't happen. Now, we will be the last of the parliaments to vote. So we're expecting to vote in March of next year. So the British government, the British Parliament will have voted, the 27 other countries will vote, and then it will come to the European Parliament. But it has to pass in the European Parliament as well. Now, as you probably know, the Labour Party set six tests that had to be addressed and cleared before the Labour Party would support any deal that the British government brought back from Brussels. And if you look at those, they're a pretty tall order to meet. And one of them, the second one on the list, is that the deal that is achieved has to deliver, quote, the exact same benefits, end of quote, as being in the single market and in the customs union. That's a very high bar to clear, the exact same benefits. So when Keir Starmer was out talking to us, his feeling is it's unlikely that the British government are going to deliver a deal which the Labour Party are going to support. We have to wait and see, but it's likely that the Labour Party will not support the deal that comes back from Brussels that the British government strike with the EU27. Now, as you know, we don't have enough votes without others supporting us. And then the Tories will have the dilemma of can they deliver the whole of the Tory vote plus the DUP to get the deal through. They'll probably get the DUP, but will they get all the Tory votes? So the Anna Soubrys, the Dominic Greaves of this world will they abstain or will they vote with Labour? And this is where the interesting scenarios begin to emerge, because if the government cannot get through something as important as the Brexit deal through Parliament, then it immediately means there would be a vote of confidence, because it's just such an important issue. If the government cannot deliver the deal in Parliament, then you have a crisis because they haven't delivered the deal, but you also have the Labour Party moving a motion of no confidence. Now, that could again go either way. We might win that, in which case you've got a general election, and that could all be before Christmas. So that business about it's going round slowly, not seeing much happening, and the fact that it's suddenly going to speed up. So you have an agreement on the Thursday, you have a vote in the House of Commons on the Monday, the government lose the vote in the House of Commons, you have a vote of no confidence on the Tuesday in the House of Commons, all still inside November, and if they lose that, you're looking at a general election. I don't think we've ever had a general election in December, but it's not impossible. Certainly possible we could be having a general election in January. Or the government could win the confidence vote, but still be in a delicate position because it's lost the Brexit deal in the House of Commons. You have a constitutional crisis on your hands in the run-up to Christmas. Can May survive that as an individual as the Prime Minister, or is there a resignation by Theresa May and the Tory party plunged into a leadership contest just before Christmas? All these things are possible. If it comes back and the deal is a very vague deal, this seems to be what the talk at the moment is, that if it'll be something called a blind Brexit, they'll have just the fuzziest outlines of a deal and it kind of works for everybody. So the Brexiteers and the Tory party are happy and the Anna Soubrys are happy because they still think that it's not as bad as it might have been, and they managed to get it through. Keir Starmer was very clear. If it's a vague, fuzzy deal, if it's a blind deal, the Labour Party won't be voting for that either. Simply not enough information. And again, that would lead us into a constitutional crisis. So I think we're looking at, between now and Christmas, a whole series of possibilities, or in January, a series of possibilities. So it's going to get very, very interesting, to say the least. And there are those like Len McCluskey in Unite who believe that the Brexit issue is the issue that the Labour Party can break the government on and get a general election. There's a strong feeling inside the trade union movement that Brexit is the way to bring down the government. It is the way to get a general election. And as you know, we're coming up to Labour Party conference starting this weekend. There's over 100 contemporary motions have gone in on the issue of Brexit. So without doubt, the Labour Party will be discussing Brexit. We didn't discuss it at the last conference in Brighton, but we will be discussing it. And part of what that discussion is going to be around is, should there be some form of second referendum, which is being called or talked about as a people's vote. So here's the deal that's come back. Here's the deal that the government have achieved. So what certainly some members of Parliament, probably cross-party, will do is, here will be the deal put in front of the House of Commons, and before we vote on the deal, there'll be an amendment put by a cross-section of people from a mixture of political parties to say that if the deal is passed in the House of Commons, it then needs to go to the people to be endorsed in some form of people's vote. It's not entirely clear what would be on the ballot paper, that's being discussed, different possibilities, but the idea that it wouldn't be the House of Commons that would have the final say, it would be the people who would have the final say. So there might be a recommendation from the British Parliament to accept the deal, and then it comes out for a referendum for the British people to decide whether or not they want to accept that final deal in a people's vote. Now, the Labour Party's position on a people's vote, when Keir Starmer was asked a couple of weeks ago in Brussels, Keir Starmer's view is that the Labour Party, the best thing for the Labour Party to do is keep all the possible options on the table. Don't rule anything in, don't rule anything out. Keep flexible to see how the situation develops, because it's a fast-moving situation. Jude and I are both in favour of the idea of some form of people's vote. We're both in the same position, as we're not entirely sure what the question should be on the paper, but the idea of taking it back to the people is one that we both support. And Jude's used the analogy, and it's an analogy which was going round inside the trade union movement when the trade unions have had their conferences over the last few weeks, where we've seen the TUC amongst as the umbrella group for the trade unions, adopt a position which is to be open-minded about the idea of a people's vote. And the idea is, or the comparison is, that if you're a workforce in negotiation with the management over pay for the year to come, you have your meeting with your trade union reps to say, well, this is what we think we'd like, etc. They go off and have the negotiations, which may could last some weeks, and then they come back and they say, this is the deal we've got. We're suggesting you either accept it or you don't accept it. We're now going to have a vote as to whether or not we accept the deal that our shop stewards have argued for us with the management. That kind of representative democracy. So we've had a referendum. We said we wanted to leave. We've had a negotiation which has lasted 2 years. We've got a deal. It's come back. Do we or don't we want to accept it as the members of the country? That kind of idea is the one that Jude was arguing for, and I think that's a good way of looking at it. Keir was also asked when he was out with us as to what was his view about the polling. The Labour Party has always, and no doubt will continue into the future, to do private polling. So we pay pollsters to go out and ask questions of small groups and of large sections of the population. So we want to have our information as to what the public out there are thinking about the issue of Brexit, the idea of a people's vote, etc. And Keir's view was that there has been a shift in the population at large. So there is a move from leave to remain, but it's a relatively small move. It's still inside the margin of error, although it's shifted towards remain. So the evidence seems to suggest if we had another referendum now, it would just be won by remain rather than just lost. But it's inside the margin of error. And he also cautioned, which I think is important to know, is that the idea of leaving without a deal, actually polls quite highly. There's a lot of people out there who think, sod them, you know, if they won't do a deal with us, we'll just leave without a deal. So we're walking on very, very thin ice. If we call this wrong, we could really mess it up. And I think that's why Keir was saying, you know, let's keep all the options on the table, because the public mood, yes, it shifted, but it could shift back or it could shift further. A very, very volatile period to be in. And last week, the Parliament was in Strasbourg. We have this strange situation where we do 3 weeks in Brussels and a week in Strasbourg, 3 weeks in Brussels, a week in Strasbourg. And the socialist group, which is over 200 strong, which is the socialist MEPs from all over 28 countries in the European Union, and the 200 of us met with Michel Barnier for a couple of hours. And he gave an update on where the talks are at. And he said two things which I think stuck out. He talked about Cameron. He talked about Cameron, who got himself into a fix and then took a gamble, and the gamble didn't pay off. He lost. And he said that you should, and obviously this was a reference to what Cameron had done as a politician, you should never sacrifice the future for the present. You should never sacrifice the future for the present. Which, alas, is what's happened. In any conversations that we tend to have with younger people, younger voters, there is a real feeling that, you know, you older folk, you took a decision about my future. And if that in that group of, if they're 19 years old, if they're 20 years old, they may have a very strong view, and 2 years ago they didn't have the chance to vote. So there's a very big bunch of young people out there who feel really cheesed off with the political class for getting them into this situation where we're now outside of the EU. Or about to be outside of the EU. And then the other thing which Barnier said in answer to one of the questions that came from the floor, he said, it's not more time that we need for these negotiations, it's decisions that we need. This idea that the British government have been negotiating for 18 months and are still not very clear about what they want, and therefore from the EU27's point of view, this is a real difficult thing to have that conversation with a negotiation with a country that doesn't seem to know what it wants out of the negotiations. So that's kind of where we're at with the Brexit process. And there's just a little observation to stick in towards the end here about what's happening on the right of politics. The right of politics at a European level and on the right of politics at a UK level, because I think as socialists we need to watch out for what's happening on the right and the far right in particular. On the right in general, there is clearly a kind of realignment taking place. You may not believe me, you may disagree with me, but there is, it's a small declining group, but but they still exist. They're called the Sensible Tories. There's still a few people out there who are in the Tory party who are perfectly sensible, sane, rational people, and yes, they're Tories, but we can do business with them because they're decent human beings as well. And there's two of them in, so they're basically, there's after the last European elections, 20 Labour MEPs elected for the country and 20 Tory MEPs elected for the country. Now, there are a really diverse 20 Tory MEPs, and two of them have left the Tory party and now sit in the mainstream Conservative group in the European Parliament. They are what I would call the Sensible Tories. They're the kind of Ted Heath-type Tories. They fell out with the mainstream Tory party in London over the whole issue of Brexit. And they're both decent people, and they've had enough. And they've gone that way, if you like. But then look at the 18 who remain. Well, the 18 who remain, 15 of them were pro-leave, hardline Brexiteers of one type or another. And last week, you may have seen this in the European Parliament, we had Viktor Orban came from Hungary. There's a move afoot, maybe long overdue, but to start to put some pressure on Hungary in particular, but also Poland and Romania, where the rule of law, the democracy indicator is pointing that, you know, things aren't looking good. So particularly in Hungary, you know, yes, he won an election, but he seems to think that having won an election as a far-right party, that means you can stamp on NGOs, take no notice of trade unions, override the courts, and stick the boot into the free media. So there's a lot happening in Hungary which is really quite unpleasant. And the European Union, in the Parliament last week in Strasbourg, we voted to start the procedures to sanction Hungary for their failure to live up to the democratic ideals of the EU. And it will be Romania next, and they're a socialist government, I'm afraid to say, and it will also be Poland, who's a right-wing government. But we need to raise the alarm that there are things happening in Eastern Europe, in the former communist countries, which from a democratic point of view are genuinely worrying. And I sat and watched across the chamber as several of the Tory MEPs repeatedly clapped Viktor Orban as he spoke. They didn't just then go on and vote in support of the Hungarian government not being sanctioned. They actually applauded him during his speech. And I think that's, along with UKIP, along with the 15 or so people who are still members of UKIP in the European Parliament. So there was a big group of British MEPs applauding Viktor Orban from Hungary. So you'll have also spotted that Stephen Wolfe, who was an MEP for the Tories from the northwest of England, has attempted to join the Tory party, but has had his membership rejected. And there's a shift of UKIP supporters to move into the Tory party as members to push the Tory party to the right to make sure that the next leader of the Tory party is a Brexiteer. So that infiltrating the Tory party ready for that election of the leader, where they hope to get a vote and hope to make sure that one of the Brexiteers is now in charge. We have to remind ourselves that Theresa May was actually in favour of remaining in the EU, although she was pretty lacklustre about it during the campaign. But they want to get one of their own in charge of the Tory party. And therefore, we've got this situation where some Tories are moving out of the Tory party because they see it as too extreme, but they're being backfilled by people from the further right, including from UKIP. And then the worst thing about all of this, and again, you need to watch out for it, is then you've got the likes of the British National Party and the far right-wing parties now moving in and becoming members of UKIP to fill the space as the whole thing shuffles along. So there's a realignment on the right taking place that I think we as socialists need to be aware of. So just to conclude, as I said at the beginning, if anybody tells you that they know what's going to happen in the next few months, they don't, because nobody knows what's going to happen. It's going to happen at a quicker and quicker pace. And when we have that meeting at some point in November when the deal is sealed, then there'll be a very, very quick sequence of events after that, which could result in the fall of the Prime Minister, could result in a vote of no confidence off the back of the failure to get the deal through the Westminster Parliament, and then could result in a general election, either in the run-up to Christmas or in the very early, straight after Christmas. So anything, I think, is now possible. And I'll leave it there. But Magnus going to say a little bit about a bit more about the wider context, and particularly something to do about how this could all impact a bit on the northeast, because obviously we're part of the Labour Party in the northeast of England. We know from the government's own research that if there were to be a no deal Brexit, which is 50-50 chance I think at the moment, then the northeast of England would take a hit of around about 16% to our GDP, which would deliver a level of unemployment that we didn't even have during the Thatcher period. So it's grim ahead if we have a no Brexit deal for the northeast, and we need to bear in mind that as one of the poorest regions in the United Kingdom, any form of Brexit is looking like a pretty rough ride in the next few, in the initial period after we've left, and maybe for many years after that.
Just before we go on for Mike to speak, we'll let Mike speak and then we'll take all the questions after that. Is that okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Over to you, Mike.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, guys. And good evening, comrades. I just want to set the thing in a little bit of context, really. I won't speak for very long because I'd rather deal with the issues that you want to raise in answering questions. Obviously, Paul has covered, if you like, the specific tactical issues about the voting and all the rest of it. But just to add one or two things, there's been a lot of talk about the deal and negotiations. When people talk about negotiations and the deal, all they're talking about really, and Paul mentioned this point as well, is an annex to the withdrawal agreement, which actually will suggest what the future framework of the relationship between the UK and the EU is going to be. That's all it ever was, and it can't be much more than that, because while we're still members, as we are now, there is no way in which the EU 27, represented by Michel Barnier, can actually negotiate anything, actually, in terms of a future trade deal. So all we're looking at, all the flim-flam and all the rest of it, tends to be about the deal and all the big arguments about the deal. What are we likely to get if there's a transition period of 21 months? What will we try and get within that, within that period in terms of trade deal? Would it be a trade deal like Canada? Would it be something like the people who suggest the European Economic Area, etc., etc., etc.? Remember, the Labour Party's current political position is that we're in favour of staying in a customs union and staying close to the internal market regulations, which actually is pretty close to the so-called Chequers deal, although that's a bit longer. But the Chequers deal, in my view, is dead in the water, despite what Theresa May says. The Barnier has made it clear there is a distinct amount of cherry picking as far as that is concerned. I mean, just very simply on that one, just to illustrate, the Chequers deal suggests we have a single market for goods, but not for services. The problem is that services and goods actually nowadays are linked together. It's not as easy as that. And the point is, it breaches the full four freedoms which Barnier and the EU always talk about. So, that means freedom of capital movement, freedom of people movement, and freedom of services. So that you're looking at something which the EU cannot accept in its current form, nor, for that matter, can the UK Parliament, as Paul has pointed out. The Labour Party position means that unless we replicate the existing arrangements and impacts of the single market and the customs union, then we'll vote it down. And there is no way that that can be obtainable. There really isn't. Interestingly, we've only ever been in the EU in terms of the single market and the customs union. We're not in Schengen. We're not in the Eurozone. We have five other opt-outs. We're barely in the EU. So the single market and the customs union are the key issue. But that's the issue about trade. And that's why, from the northeast point of view, because we are very dependent on trade with the rest of the EU. And we have a surplus. We have an export surplus with the rest of the EU. But the key point I want to make, I've mentioned that the deal, the annex, is about what a trade deal might look like once it's been negotiated, but it can't be the deal itself. And in fact, I think the British government seems at the moment to be accepting that that's all that would be in the annex. It would be a fairly short annex. But the real problem is the withdrawal agreement. This has to be legally binding on both sides. This is a legal document. People don't seem to understand, and perhaps they've never understood it. I've been involved with the EU, both inside and outside the EU, for 45 years. People do not understand that the EU is a constitutional legal entity, because we don't do constitutionalism in Britain. We don't have a codified constitution. We have bits and pieces, but we don't. And that's very important, which is why in discussing the withdrawal agreement, whether it's migrant workers' rights or whether it's Northern Ireland, I'll come back to that in a moment, what the EU is trying to do is to fasten this down in the form of a legal agreement, which is what happened in December. And that happened, as far as Northern Ireland is concerned, in terms of the backstop agreement. Now, not only have I been involved in the EU for 45 years, mostly outside of Chastenheim, but also inside. But I also know Northern Ireland quite well, and I have done for 42 years. And I have relatives there, etc. Some of the extreme Tories, including two previous Northern Ireland secretaries, went to say that Northern Ireland is not really important. It's been blown up at Waterloo. Absolute nonsense. What people don't realise, unless they know Northern Ireland very well, is that the old resentments are still there. The bigotry is still there beneath the surface. It hasn't gone away. It's been subdued, and younger people happily are able to go out at night in Belfast and enjoy themselves and move freely down to the south, and they tend to refer it as that rather than Ireland. And any kind of change in the situation, particularly if you have a border, will create a problem. Hence the EU, because it is also a legal guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement. People say, well, why should the EU be involved in this? They are a legal guarantor. That's why they're concerned about it, apart from the fact the Irish government is one of the 27, so therefore they are concerned about this. And as May suggested this morning, one thing I did agree with, if you move the border 20 miles away from the actual border, that doesn't make the slightest difference. It's still a border. But it's the psychological impact of the border which is the problem. And the fact that we've had peace in Northern Ireland partly because we have both been members of the EU. Now, the final thing I just want to mention before I open it up for discussion, is that I do not want another referendum. I actually disagree with Paul and Jude about this and others. It was bad enough having one referendum, which has been enormously divisive, and it's still being divisive, even though there is some suggestion of shifting of public opinion. And no decision was taken in that referendum. People make a mistake. It was advisory. The only decision that was taken was the triggering, as I think Paul mentioned actually, the triggering of Article 50 by the UK Parliament. That's the only decision. Advisory referendum did not commit the government or Parliament to do anything. Parliament chose to initiate the process. But the point is that process now is looking like a bit of a mess. Nobody, I mean, this, to me, as somebody who's lived with the EU for all this time, it's kind of Kafkaesque, unrealistic position. It's madness. And I mean, I know there are some people on the left who take the view that, oh, well, it's a neoliberal market economy, it's a capitalist club. Hang on a minute, which country are you living in? We're neoliberal. In fact, of all the 28 countries, we're probably the most neoliberal, actually, and we've driven a neoliberal agenda over the last 40-odd years within the EU. So I think it's important to set these things in context. The other final point I would make, we spent 43 years, and government spent 43 years, up to the referendum, blaming the EU for everything. Nonsensical things like they were banning King Edward potatoes, and they were bent potatoes, all this sort of nonsense. But anything went wrong, it's the EU. You do that for 43 years, then you have a referendum, and you expect people, particularly people in this region that have been left behind for 40 years through Labour as well as Tory governments, you expect them, looking at their social condition, to suddenly turn to you and say, oh, okay, that's fine. No, we didn't tell people that the UK economy is probably 20% bigger now than it would have been if we'd not been in the EU. And that's looking at the past, estimates about the future and the impact. There will be an impact, and it will be negative, particularly for this region. How much, how long it will take, I'm an economist, it's very difficult to make those estimates, but there will be damage, and it will go on, and it won't be easy. And this region, and people you will know, will suffer, and I'm not sure that's what we should be in favour of.
Thank you for that. Take questions now. Any questions? I'll take the first one. Just say your name and where you're
from. Okay, my name's Ed Bober, and I'm from Wansbeck Branch, Labour Party. I've kind of got two questions. If the comrades on the panel don't mind, first of all, in regard to a second referendum or the people's vote, I think that most of us in the Labour Party were pretty disappointed when Cameron went for the first referendum. And one of the effects it had, there'd been, you know, in the background, there'd been all kinds of blaming of migrant workers from Poland and, you know, too many foreigners and all that, blaming them for the effects of Tory policies, of cuts in welfare spending and that kind of thing. And it allowed, the referendum allowed all that nationalism and bigotry to blow up far bigger than we would have liked as Labour Party members, because it did not promote the solidarity of the working class in Britain. It did not make Polish workers in Norfolk or Lincolnshire feel more part of the labour force in Britain. It made them feel more marginalised. And if there were a second referendum, would it not just bring out all those sentiments again? In instead of allowing us, the Labour Party, to focus on the issues that, you know, we want a more equal society. We want to stop this Tory policy of the rich getting richer while the poor can't even pay their bills. And surely a second referendum would distract, it would deflect from all of those issues and take people up this sort of blind alley of arguing about nationalism again. That's the first question. The second question is, I think you said I think it was Paul that said, you know, with the maybe it was Mike, with the Chequers deal is not very different from what the Labour Party stands for. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't imagine that shower of so-called politicians in Chequers being interested in workers' rights when we come out of the EU, being interested in environmental protection, being interested in, you know, in the possibility of trade unions representing people more fully at work. And it seems to me that what Theresa May's cabinet is trying to do, and the UKIP lot who are her cheerleaders, is use Brexit to deregulate as much as possible. And surely, you know, again, as a Labour Party, surely what we have to be doing is emphasising that whatever comes out of Brexit, we want the rights of the working class to be foremost and prominent. But there's two questions, anyway.
Shall I do the first one? On your analysis, to begin with, on the first question, I completely agree. What the referendum unleashed was decidedly unpleasant, and the stories of people from overseas receiving abuse all across the country in the days after the referendum and in the months since, which they never got before, you know, is there for people to see. It's on the record. My own daughter came home from school in the run-up to Christmas and said one of her friends was going to be leaving. Her dad, German cancer specialist for children at the RVI in Newcastle, now lost to the North East and lost to the United Kingdom because he didn't feel welcome after Brexit and has left and gone back, was going to work in Amsterdam. So yes, your analysis is correct. And then I think we're all then struggling with, but then what do we do? I think you're weighing up the arguments. Do we have some form of referendum or not? And Michael's absolutely right that the vote that we took as the British people was advisory. So the House of Commons, in theory, could have said, well, thank you very much for your advice, British people, but we're not going to take any notice and we're not going to trigger Article 50. That was theoretically possible. But I think once a referendum was called, we kind of knew that Parliament was then going to have to follow through on the decision that was then made by the British people. And my feeling, and the feeling of many people who, you know, were not delighted at all about the idea of having some form of second referendum for the very reasons you've argued, but our feeling is that the only way you can undo a referendum is with another referendum. And therefore, if the British people have decided, as they narrowly did, to leave the EU, then it's only people who can change that. The only way of changing that in a parliamentary democracy without undermining the very democracy we all believe in is to say to the people, are you absolutely sure that you want to do this? And if the people are absolutely sure and they vote in that second referendum, then we get on with it and we do it. And the worry would be that if a Labour government came to power after a government collapsed in the next few months, and we took the decision as the Labour Party that we were going to revoke Article 50 and not leave the EU without consulting the British people. Now, you could put it in the manifesto, and if we won a general election on that basis, you could argue that it was in the manifesto that we were going to stop Brexit. But I think there's a feeling that it's highly unlikely that the Labour Party, as it currently stands, would put that in a manifesto before a general election called in March, before March of next year. So we've discussed it over and over again as the Socialist MEPs. We've discussed it as the Labour MEPs in the European Parliament. There's a whole range of views. We've gone round and round. And I think the majority feeling is shifting behind some form of second vote, which is why that over 100 resolutions have gone into the Labour Party for it to be discussed at conference, suggesting that that becomes the Labour Party's position. We'll have to wait and see as to what happens. My guess is that the Labour Party conference will keep the options open. We'll say it's something that we're willing to look at, but our priority is to try and achieve a general election and bring the government down to fit with your last point, which is, you know, if you're forced, you know, it isn't a binary choice. It isn't either bring the Tories down and win an election or do something about Brexit. We've got to bring the two together. And I think Lynn McCluskey is probably right. Brexit is probably our best way of bringing down the government. Well, if they fail to deliver on the deal in the Houses of Parliament, they can't get it through. Therefore, we have that vote of confidence. Can we vote that, win that vote of confidence and force a general election?
Let me just pick on two things. The second point, I was not implying clearly that the Labour Party position and the Tory Party position in terms of what they will want to do assuming Brexit went ahead. No, clearly not. Clearly there's a massive divide between what we want to do in terms of moving towards a socialist UK and what the Tories want to do. The point I was making was that both the Labour Party position and what they're trying to do with Chequers is to stay as close to the EU as possible in terms of trade. That's important. For instance, to deal with the problem that Nissan has, of supply chains, of long and complex supply chains, which will attract, every time the peace part moves across, there's a 4.5% tariff. But it's not just that, it's the time issue and the other technical issues which create problems. So all I was doing, drawing attention to the fact that what we're doing is to stay relatively close to the EU, and that's what the government is trying to do, but they're also trying to finesse other things as well, which we do not want. Can I just pick up, give you on the issue of parliamentary sovereignty on the one hand and referenda on the other, because I'm totally opposed to referenda for at national level on complex issues. Let me give an example. If you look at capital punishment, in 1983, 75% of the UK population favoured a return to capital punishment. Only in 2015 did it fall below 50% for the first time. Now, I usually ask MPs, what would you do if the referendum, therefore, had been on capital punishment? Would you then go ahead? Would you then accept the will of the people as expressed in a referendum? No. I mean, the answer is no, we wouldn't. The argument they put forward is this is a matter of conscience. No, it's a matter of judgment. And that's exactly the same position. Now, I appreciate that at the time when Parliament decided to implement Article 50, it wasn't long after the referendum. It would have been quite difficult, particularly as no arguments were put forward, to say, to actually challenge directly the narrow majority for leave. But now, I think it's perfectly possible to argue the case that, given what we know, that that can and perhaps should be done.
I'll take the gentleman next to you, the cap on.
You mentioned that.
Can you see who you
sorry,
are? Where you're from?
From Black. You mentioned that the deal would have to be confirmed by 65% of the European members left in the party, so they would be the finance ministers that would be likely to decide on it, with the German finance minister there, and after they drove the knife into Greece and made an example of them and imposed X, Y, and Z austerity, do you not think they'd really make the case to put a knife in us to prove a point and keep Europe consolidated?
Well, it was certainly one of the strong arguments during the referendum campaign was, would it be in the interests of the EU27 to give Britain a good exit deal? And that's continued all the way through. And I think I understand where the argument came from, which said that they will have to make an example of us, because otherwise other countries might start to leave and say, look, we'll have a good deal like Britain's had, and etc. I think in all of my experience of regularly going out to Brussels, is I haven't picked up any sense of our fellow, the EU27 countries wanting in any way to be vindictive towards us.
My question is more about the finance minister of Germany, just after the hell for Greece through and the rise of the Nazi parties and stuff like that in Greece. And if our GDP declines by 16%, will that not make politics worse in this country and the divisions between the two people?
So I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think it's going to happen because of the... Because we're a big country that's leaving, then it does have implications for the EU27. Ireland in particular, it has massive implications for. It has huge implications for a country like the Netherlands, where the majority of their exports in the food industry come to the United Kingdom. So, and the way that the economies, and this is part of the argument for why we shouldn't be leaving, is the more you look at it, the more you see how the single market has worked over the last 20 years, and we've become more and more integrated. So if you look at how cars are put together, the pieces go backwards and forwards, as Michael was saying. And it's in nobody's interest for us to leave. And if we are going to leave, actually, the EU27 do want to have a sensible, close relationship with the United Kingdom after we've left. So the chances are that there will be a deal. The question is, can the deal be stomached by the right-wing Brexiteers? That's the real question. And if you start to pander to the right wing, then you lose the sensible Tories. So May's got this incredibly difficult, it's like trying to land an aeroplane a ship at sea with a ship moving backwards and forwards and the plane being buffeted, can't you manage to do it? It's incredibly difficult to do. But I don't get any sense, if we were a smaller country leaving, I think it might possibly have been tempting for them to do that to us. But because we're a big country, I just don't think it's going to happen. So I understand where the question comes from, but I'm genuinely not worried about that.
Can I ask one more quick question? Sorry.
Come on.
Very quick.
You have to ask the chair.
Well, I'd like to move around if you don't mind. It's just that there's quite a lot of you here, so we'll try and take the questions from everybody if we can.
I'm from Blythe. My question is, if there was a vote of confidence and Labour got in, is there any possibility of Labour stopping the Brexit process? The reason I'm asking that is because when the vote happened the first time, I voted to leave. The reason I voted to leave was because I disagreed with us winning in the first place. But now we're so intrinsically tied to them. Before we had the Commonwealth and we had the, the cheap imports coming from the Commonwealth, we've lost all that. So we're intrinsically tied. But my concern is, if Labour was to get into power just before Brexit, so in effect, when Brexit takes place, Labour's got the keys to number 10. The economy drops. Now people are fickle, they look and they'll blame Labour for everything that's happened. I mean, when there was the financial crash, right, Gordon Brown's parliament was blamed for it, and it wasn't his fault.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't see that. They just say, Labour had the keys.
Yeah.
Labour messed up the economy. That's what Labour does. So is there any likelihood if the Labour government got in the mid?
Just very quickly, I mean, I think that you've hit on the key thing, though. What exactly, it's okay, the tactics of the Labour Party. The Labour Party doesn't have to do anything, actually, basically, because the Tories make such a bloody unholy mess of it. But all we have to do is be quite canny. And we are being quite canny, frankly. But the real issue is, what is the strategic position of the Labour Party? If, as I want, a general election, and I want a Corbyn-led government, if Brexit takes place, there will be an even bigger mess. There's a mess now. Prisons, schools, social care, health care. We really have a dysfunctional economy and society and politics. It'll be even worse if Brexit takes place. So what exactly, if we go into an election, what exactly is the Labour Party's position? We did campaign in the referendum for Remain. And 66% of Labour voters actually voted Remain. I think there is a fairly large chunk of Labour voters that would appreciate, providing it's sold properly and communicated properly, then I think it could be done. But as I say, at the moment, we don't have a strategic position. We're just engaging in tactics because that's all we have.
And it's worth bearing in mind that the Labour Party position hasn't changed since the referendum, because we didn't discuss it at the conference last year. So actually the Labour Party position is, if you like, unchanged from 2 years ago. But I think I've heard people in the Tory Party, Tory politicians say, I really hope that you're running the country after Brexit, not us. You're absolutely right. It is common, it seems to have entered into common parlance out there, common knowledge, that the crash was caused by Gordon Brown and the Labour government, which is a complete rubbish. It was a global crash, which happened anyway. And you can argue whether Gordon did a good or a bad job at trying to deal with it. I think he did a very good job at trying to put together a collective coalition at a global level to do something about it. But he bloody well didn't cause it. But if we're running the country in the months after Brexit, and all of the things that we think are going to be problematic about Brexit, the Tory Party, which is the most successful political machine of the last 100 years in this country, far better than we've been, combined with the Tory media, will hang it round our neck infinitum that it was nothing to do with Brexit. It was everything to do with what happens when you put the socialists in charge of the country. And we could then lose 3 consecutive general elections after that if we lose control of the narrative, if we were in power. So it's high, high stakes. So we need to be very, very careful. Now, the brave thing to do, in my opinion, the brave thing to do would be to put in a Labour Party manifesto that if we win the general election, we're not going to leave the European Union. That would be the brave thing to do. Now, whether the front bench are up for that, I don't know. But I think we would definitely win a general election on that, because you would have people who would vote Labour for the first time in their lives on a manifesto like that. A whole bunch of Liberal Democrats and surprisingly large number of sensible, not members of the Tory party, we don't want them anyway, but people who traditionally have voted Tory, who would then come round and say, on this occasion I'm going to hold my nose and I'm going to go in and vote for the Labour Party because they're the sensible party on Brexit. We'd have a very different political map. We would win seats that we wouldn't expect to win. We would lose seats that we'd expect to hold on to, but we would form the government and we'd be in power.
Right, I'm going to bring in Connor and then it's you behind then.
Yeah, right. Connor from Cramlington. It's kind of further to the point on nationalism that came up earlier. In 2016, I essentially only made up my mind to vote Remain in the last week on the basis that a vote to leave will definitely strengthen the fascists and there'll be like a massive spike in hate crimes, and I was proved right, although we still voted to leave. I'm very concerned that if we, either through parliamentary means or through a people's vote, try and have a stance of negating Brexit and reversing it, that that would cause a kind of stab in the back myth, much like what happened in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, and it didn't immediately cause, I mean, it did immediately cause revolutions and Hitler marching on Munich in 1923, but it kind of just festered for a decade and a half, and then you get fascism in the 1930s, and I could very concretely see if Brexit was averted, although that would be much more beneficial for the economy, that causing a festering narrative on the far right, on the UKIP, they wouldn't be a parliamentary force, but they would be a force enough culturally to pull off a sort of Trumpian move and shift the Tory party enough to the right to adopt very backward positions. And I'm just wondering what you thought about that potentiality.
It's a danger, but I don't think it's what would happen. And it is, as Paul just said, it's a question of controlling the narrative. One thing we're not very good at, or haven't been very good at, except the last election, is controlling the narrative and actually being able to communicate our message, which is, you know, the message of hope, if you remember. That was the main message. That, you know, that went home. But my idea is concerning. I'm trying to book on nationalist populism. So I know there are dangers, but you have to make a stand. And you have to say why you're doing it, why it's beneficial to people, and bring people with you. That's what democracy is partly about, convincing people. So, yeah, it's a danger.
Yeah, and I mean, you're quite right. I mean, Billy Bragg said in the run-up to the referendum, not everybody who's voting Leave is a fascist, but all fascists are voting Leave. But you need to, you paint a bleak picture of what might happen, but also look at the bleak picture of what will happen on the other side. So we leave, the economy of the North East takes a massive hit, we have unemployment higher than we had in Mrs. Thatcher's time. What is the breeding ground for fascism? Unemployment. So either way, we're in a bad place.
Okay, gentlemen.
Yeah. Hi, Peter Parish from Holywell and St. Dunbar branch.